constitutional law. Now we're getting into other congressional powers that are afforded, and specifically we're going to be talking about the taxing and spending power in this. They are often talked about separately, but they go hand in hand in the same constitutional clause. And the reason why they go hand in hand is because spending is actually specifically not mentioned in the Constitution, but a lot of it is inferred just based off of the text that is there. Okay, so now we're continuing with our discussion about NFIB versus Cibeles. And as you recall, the individual mandate of the Affordable Care Act, which required individuals to pay for health insurance if they did not have health insurance via their taxes, well, then that was unconstitutional underneath the Commerce Clause. But underneath the taxing and spending power, it is a constitutional act. I won't get into many of the discussions about why, but I just want to state the rule, and then we'll move on to the next part of the case as well. So, pretty much, Congress is free to tax the nation if it does, one, does not impose a penalty, two, if the tax does not contain a scienter requirement, and that's just pretty much saying, if you don't pay your taxes, it's going to be a crime. And three, if the tax is issued by an agency that is authorized to collect revenue, so specifically the IRS. Okay, so all three of these requirements were met in this case, according to the majority opinion. It fails underneath the Commerce Clause, but it passes underneath this taxing power. Ultimately, we can infer from that then that the taxing and spending power is also exercised more broadly than the Commerce Clause. That's going to be our big takeaway from this section of Cibeles, is that Congress is free to tax if it does not impose a penalty, if there's no scienter requirement, and if it is authorized by an agency who has the power to collect taxes. One thing that's important, interesting to note, too, I won't spend a ton of time on this, but when Congress was, so to speak, touting, applauding their bill, they said, no, this is not a penalty. This is not a tax. This is not a tax. Because if you say this is a tax to Congress and to your constituents, they're not going to want to vote for it. And so all throughout the passing process, they said, this is not a tax. It's only a penalty. And don't worry, it's only a penalty. It's not a tax. But then once it got to court, all the proponents for the Affordable Care Act are saying, this is a tax. Because if it's not constitutional underneath the Commerce Clause, well, then this needs to be constitutional underneath the taxing power. And so they say that this is a tax. Okay, so that's the taxing power. Let's get into the spending power with this. Note, both the commerce and the taxing power dealt with the individual mandate. Now we're going to be talking about the Medicaid expansion part of the Affordable Care Act. Notice there were those two parts. The individual mandate required people to pay, but the Medicaid expansion was related to the states. All right. Prior to this bill being passed, Medicaid was already a thing, but it was pretty limited in its use. It applied to only the severely ill, the utterly blind, the severely disabled, and the Medicaid expansion wanted to expand that to anybody underneath the age of 65 who was significantly below the poverty line. And that was the goal of the Medicaid expansion, was to, well, expand Medicaid to everybody. All the states prior to this had signed on to Medicaid and were receiving federal funding for Medicaid care within their state. And so now this provision is just trying to broaden it out and require the states to broaden it out in order to receive Medicaid funding. And that's really the issue in the case here. If the state did not adopt the plan, they did not get any of the Medicaid funding. They didn't get to keep any of the old money, but they didn't get to keep any of the new money. And they didn't get to keep any of the new money. So as a result, it was a take it or leave it. You lose everything you have, or you accept this bill. And you implement this plan in order to get the necessary funding to make it work. In short, it's an all or nothing deal, and the majority says that it is coercive. You either take the expansion or get nothing. Right? And as a result, the coercion is so dramatic that the program is practically a new program. It's not an expansion of the old program, but it's something that you could say is entirely new. It's not an amendment. It's a shift from one kind to another. The Ginsburg dissent says that this is simply an alteration of the old Medicaid funding. It's not a new program. Instead, it's just an expansion of that program. And as a result, just as you needed to be underneath the old program, follow the requirements underneath the old program, you also had to follow the requirements of the new program to get that funding. And if you failed to do so, well, then you would be opted out of that old program, just as you would be opted out of this same program, just with more requirements. And so that's really the difference in arguments there. Once again, I do just want to note that the joint dissent agrees that the Medicaid expansion is unconstitutional, but disagrees that it can be severed. And so the joint dissent argues that the entire Affordable Care Act should be unconstitutional. I do want to note that the quote-unquote penalty was 100%. You would lose all of the funding. We have a different case in Dakota v. Dole, where the statute required states to up their drinking age to 21%, or else they would lose 5% of their highway funding. So, Dole actually was upheld as a good statute, a good use of the spending power, because it was only 5%. So we notice this difference here. It's got to be 5% is okay for the statute. Congress can regulate, take away 5% of funding. But 100% of funding is not okay. So we don't know where the line is, but it's somewhere in between those two. And because the 5% here, the 5% is not coercive, and there needs to be this connection between the condition and the incentive. So ultimately, we're left with three elements here in order for the funding, in order to find the act constitutional. First, it needs to be not coercive, and that's the issue with the 100%. Second, there needs to be a relationship between the condition and the incentive, meaning, for example, the drinking age to 21, the connection between the condition and the incentive was that people are driving on the freeways and they're dangerous driving as teenagers drinking. And so to increase the safety of the highways, you want to restrict who has access to that. And as a result, there is this connection between the condition and the incentive. And third, it needs to be unambiguous of what the condition is. If there's any ambiguity, then it's going to be unconstitutional. Okay, we have one last case. This is United States v. Butler. This is an older case. It's not recent. The other two cases are recent. This one was agriculture. It's about the same time as our Wickard case in the Commerce Clause section. But this said that the spending power restricted Congress's authority, but it did allow broad access. And that's really our big takeaway there. Commerce regulates directly. The taxing and spending power is really just an incentive to self-regulate. And that's Congress's power underneath the taxing and spending power. We're getting into a field now where I'm a little more uncomfortable with the content. It's going to be a little bit of a learning curve, so I ask you to bear with me. Thanks. Bye. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Law Schoolers. Before I let you go, there are four things I want to say. The first thing is, if you enjoyed these episodes and if you enjoyed the website, I would invite you to go and join Law Schoolers Pro. And you can do that by going to lawschoolers.com/join. It's a way for you to support us, but there's also a lot of features there that I think you will enjoy. Second thing is that nearly all of our episodes are unedited. The only ones that aren't are pre-law materials. And the reason for that is so you can actually see the legal material in its raw form as I'm learning it as well. The third thing is that the information contained in these episodes are specifically only for educational purposes. They're not to be used as legal advice. And with that, the fourth thing is, if it is used as legal advice, we are not liable. That is, Law Schoolers is not liable for any legal outcomes. Thank you again for enjoying the show. Have a good one.